May it please the court. My name is Dana Weiss, registration 36656. I work with the Public Defender's Office, and I represent Mr. Campbell. I'd like to focus today's argument on the first issue contained in Mr. Campbell's brief concerning the illegal search of the car. The Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution and Article 2, Section 7 of the Colorado Constitution protect all individuals against unlawful and unreasonable governmental searches and seizures. And that means all people, whether you belong to a minority group, whether you're rich, whether you're poor, and whether you're on parole or not. Warrantless searches are per se unreasonable under the Constitution, subject to only a few specifically established and well-delineated exceptions. The police have to have a warrant to search a person or their belongings unless an exception applies. And this warrant requirement ensures that any infringement upon these constitutional rights is supported by probable cause to believe that a crime has been committed. And this means normally an officer, police officer, must fill out a sworn affidavit. It has to be true and correct, and it has to include all information necessary for a magistrate or a judge to sign off on it, confirming that probable cause does indeed exist and authorizing that a search may be conducted. In other words, there has to be a good, legitimate reason for the government to get past an individual's constitutional right to protecting their privacy. And why do we have these constitutional rights and requirements? Because our founding fathers wanted to protect the individual's right to be secure in their privacy against overarching or overreaching abuse of power by the government. And that's what we have in this case. The officers in this case asked my client, Mr. Campbell, if he would consent to allow them to search when they stopped his vehicle. And he exercised his constitutional right to say no. So what did the officers do? They filled out a sworn affidavit. They presented it to a magistrate, a judge, to sign, saying that Mr. Campbell was suspected of being involved in a home invasion robbery or burglary, even though the lead investigating officer had determined that no crime, no burglary, no home invasion robbery had indeed occurred.
Counsel, didn't that officer testify that he hadn't determined that? He had an opinion on the matter, but it was not for him to make the call as to whether a home invasion robbery had occurred.
Officer Blackburn testified, and this is in the April 22nd hearing on page 25. He testified that he had determined that no robbery had occurred. And he made that determination based on a series of facts that, based on his training and expertise, he believed no robbery had occurred. He responded to the scene. The person made, or the complainant in that case, was inconsistent. Their story was uncorroborated. And there were no visible injuries, as he said he had been beaten up. And that individual didn't ultimately want to pursue the case.
Counsel, even if we accept the position that the portions of the sworn affidavit pertaining to the suspected robbery were stale or inaccurate, why doesn't the following statement, which is also in the affidavit, why doesn't that support the granting of the affidavit? And specifically, I'd like to refer you to the portion where the officer says, Campbell also said he had Mr. Scott in his car, which he referred to it as being similar to that of marijuana but containing no THC. He said he could be returned to prison if he was in possession of the substance he referred to as Mr. Scott. Why doesn't that portion of the affidavit provide sufficient information to create probable cause?
Well, first of all, I'll try and answer that in a series of responses. First of all, that was the last statement in the affidavit. The affidavit was primarily based on this alleged home invasion burglary that he was never charged with. But secondly, the Mr. Smiley was determined to be a tobacco product, essentially, that Mr. Campbell believed because he was on parole. And again, his subjective belief doesn't play into this determination at all. But his possession of this Mr. Smiley substance was basically a tobacco product he described as being similar to marijuana because it was a leafy substance containing none of the essential ingredients in marijuana that make it illegal. And Officer Reed, the individual, the officer who filled out the search warrant and submitted it to the magistrate, testified that he knew by the time he filled out that affidavit that Mr. Smiley was a legal substance. And that was in the April 18th hearing on page 84, when Officer Reed was specifically asked, were you aware at the time that you filled out the affidavit that Mr. Smiley was legal? And he said, yes, indeed, he did know at that point that it was illegal. And then that takes us to one of the exceptions that's addressed in the Attorney General's answer brief, and that is a parolee's expectation of privacy is sometimes considered to be lesser. And while there is some case law out there, and the McCullough case addresses this and is exactly on point, that a parolee is subject to lesser expectation of privacy with their parole officer, that does not translate to a lesser expectation of privacy when they're stopped on the street by officers, for example. It only pertains to the parole expectations or conditions that are imposed upon them, and it allows parole officers. And the parole officer was never involved in this case. They did not direct the officers to search. It was not, this had nothing to do with Mr. Campbell's parole.
So, counsel, make sure I understand your position. Are you saying that when an affidavit indicates that a person may have violated his parole, even though the actual violation may not be a law violation, it would be merely a violation of parole, that would not provide probable cause to search?
Absolutely not. Probable cause has to be based on a sufficient nexus to believe that a crime has been committed. Parole conditions are administrative regulations or administrative conditions essentially imposed upon a parolee in furtherance of their rehabilitation once somebody is released from prison. For example, they may impose a curfew upon the individual. A grown, 30-year-old man, for example, could be told you can't leave your house after 8 o'clock at night. And if that individual is stopped on the street by officers, police officers, unrelated to his parole or unrelated to his parole officer directing that a search be conducted, that's not a violation of the law. And that would not be grounds to search that individual. Just because somebody violates the terms of their parole does not say that, or does not mean or translate to them being subject to any governmental search and seizure when they're out on the street.
Make sure I understand this. You're saying that if the police have probable cause to believe of a parole violation that otherwise wouldn't be a crime, they can't get a warrant for a search?
I don't believe that there's no basis to believe that they can actually get a warrant to search based on that.
Do you have any law that would support that proposition?
McCullough is the case that I directed the court to before, and that specifically addresses that individuals, even individuals on parole, do maintain their constitutional right to be free from government searches and seizures.
Sure, but if there's probable cause of a parole violation, then that satisfies the Constitution.
And I think it's easy to get confused in terms of an incident being a parole violation, which is not a law violation, versus a law violation, committing a crime, an offense of a statutory delineated crime within the Colorado Revised Statutes. A parole officer can search, and that's what McCullough addresses.
But a police officer can't.
Correct. And McCullough addresses this part, or this point, is directly on point with this proposition.
Could a police officer get an arrest warrant for the same person based on the same information that the person has violated his parole?
I don't believe that there's any case law to support that or addressing that particular issue.
What about the fact that the affidavit mentioned that the complaining witness had said that all of the persons possessed guns in the incident? I mean, that would seem to be both a crime and a parole violation, independent of whether any robbery actually was committed.
Absolutely, if it were true. And that's where Officer Blackman's determination, based on his training and expertise, when he interviewed this witness, and he specifically outlined in his information and his reports that this individual alleged that guns were involved at some point, but he also alleged that guns were never involved. And indeed, there were no guns ever recovered, and ultimately there were no guns ever used or suspected to be used, ultimately.
But we don't look at what happened after the fact. We just look at what facts existed at the time the affidavit and the warrant were issued.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the officer, Officer Blackburn, had determined that the complainant in this case was not credible. He had made inconsistent, that being one of inconsistent statements, excuse me, that being one of the inconsistent statements with the gun.
Counsel, the search in this case occurred on the same day that the reported robbery, the report of a suspected robbery was made. Now, what is your client's position regarding how current an affidavit has to be? Is it his position that every time new information comes into the police officers, they have the burden of submitting a new affidavit? I mean, what is your position on that? On that point, how does this information have to be?
Well, I think that the information at the time that the warrant is executed, it has to be current at all times. And this is where Rusum addresses the stale warrant issue. Now, of course, Rusum addressed a warrant that they waited 7 days to execute, so it's factually a little bit different. But it does still have language in that case addressing the fact that a warrant, even when it's executed within the prescribed period of time, can still be stale if information known to the officers renders it so. And in this case, we have, pursuant to the fellow officer rule, for example, we have all the officers working in concert with one another, and we don't even need to impute knowledge, as the fellow officer rule requires. We have actual knowledge because these officers all congregated back at the station, discussed what they knew, discussed what information they had learned, and they determined that Officer Blackburn had determined no crime had occurred. And in fact, Officer Blackburn had said that he believed that they were still pursuing that warrant because based on the traffic stop of Mr.
That determination ultimately up to the DA's office, the district attorney's state of information that the officers gathered, and they decide whether or not to proceed. It's not ultimately the decision of the police office. Can you address that?
Admittedly, the facts below were not really fleshed out in terms of when do they submit all reports? Do the police submit every single report that's written to the DA's office or not? But what we do know is that an officer, the lead investigating officer, had determined that no crime had been committed. He got a no prosecution form. He determined that the complainant was not credible. He determined that there was no corroboration. And in fact, Officer Reed and Officer Duran, when they stopped Mr. Campbell on the side of the road, had determined that the items in the back of his car, he had reported himself as being stolen the day before. And of course, Mr. Campbell had told the officers that those items he had just recovered, they had been reported stolen the day before. So at that point, their collective knowledge, they knew enough to know that this was not going to be pursued. So that's what, and I think that based on the totality of the circumstances, when you're looking at an omission in an affidavit, that's what you're to determine. And based on the totality of the circumstances, especially since the lead investigating officer had determined no crime had been committed, it was no longer a valid warrant. It was rendered misleading.
Counsel, could I ask you a record clarification? You said earlier that Officer Reed knew at the time that he executed the affidavit that this Mr. Smiley's substance was legal. What was the basis for Mr. Reed's or Officer Reed's conclusion? Was it simply Mr. Campbell's statement or was some other information?
You know, at that point, what he indicated was that when he first contacted Mr. Campbell, he wasn't sure what it was. But by the time he went back to the station and transported Mr. Campbell back to the station, he was aware that Mr. Smiley was a legal substance. And that was his testimony on that April 18th hearing on page 85.
Thank you.
I believe it was 85, 84, 85.
Thank you.
And if I may, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
You may. Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Gabriel Olivares, attorney registration number 45336, and I represent the people in this matter. In this case, the trial court properly denied the defendant's motion to suppress and properly admitted evidence obtained in the search of the defendant's vehicle because the search was based on a valid warrant, which was supported by probable cause. There were no omissions of material facts. There were no misrepresentations. There were only a difference of opinions between officers on how to proceed with the investigation of the case.
Counsel, but don't the police have an obligation when asking for a warrant to give full information to the court so that the court is aware that there is this difference of opinion? That's, for example, that one officer who has actually interviewed the complaining witness doesn't think this witness is credible.
I believe they have an obligation to provide material facts, whether that covers subjective opinions of officers, whether officers have to poll every officer involved in the investigation to determine whether or not they think the circumstances merit further investigation. I don't believe the law requires that.
But that's not what I'm asking. For example, it is an objective fact that the complaining witness made inconsistent statements. It is an objective fact that the complaining witness said on the one hand that there had been guns, and said on the other hand later there had not been guns. There were several inconsistencies like that. That's not a matter of opinion. And if I'm a magistrate looking at a warrant, I think I might want to know those things.
Certainly. And facts like those normally would be required. However, it should be pointed out that officers Reed and Durant did not, there's no evidence that they knew of those inconsistencies. On page 25 of the April 22nd transcript, Officer Blackburn was specifically asked, did you tell them about the inconsistencies in his statement? And Officer Blackburn said, I don't recall going that far in depth. I recall telling them about the no prosecution forms.
Right, so if the officer Blackburn said he told the other officers that the victim did not want to prosecute, but that objective fact was not included in the affidavit.
That's true, and I think defense counsel, I don't believe, argued that that was one of the material omissions, but even if it was, I believe the probable cause still would have existed. You can look at the circumstances that happened before he signed the no prosecution forms, such as he positively identified the car, he identified three black males, he identified the defendant by name, and then later, after the police arrived, he said that an Xbox and a laptop computer had been taken from his residence, and when Officer Reeser pulled the car over that matched the description, he found the driver matched the identification, and he also observed two items in the back seat of the car. And given the fact that Mr. Cleveland signed no prosecution form, there could be all reasons for signing that.
Counsel, let's talk about the car.
Certainly.
Okay. So at the point that the search warrant affidavit was submitted to the court to approve the search of the car, at that point, the car is in police custody. The car is protected from any dissipation of evidence that it may contain. So why shouldn't we require police officers to provide, to, you know, withdraw the old affidavit, which now contains the same facts, and provide a new affidavit with the current facts? Again, we don't have the risk that the car's going to go away anywhere. The car is impounded. So can you address that?
The car was impounded before the affidavit was submitted. So the car was impounded around a little after noon. The search affidavit was signed, or the warrant was signed by the magistrate at 3:18, and the search happened 1 hour after the warrant was issued. So I don't think anything happened in that hour that would require a new affidavit be signed out, or the warrant having gone stale. The circumstances were still the same.
Didn't something happen? Didn't the police release Mr. Campbell without any charges?
The police actually released the defendant prior to the affidavit being signed. But the timing, it all happens very quickly. You have to remember that the first call to 911 happened a little after 11. The search happened a little after 4. So in these 5 hours, it's a life of an investigation. And Officer Blackburn indicated that he called or talked to Officers Reed and Duran probably a little after 2, and that the defendant was released right after that. But I don't believe the defendant's release changes the circumstances. I'm sure there's all sorts of reasons.
Well, doesn't that suggest the police didn't have probable cause to think he committed the robbery? Otherwise, why would they have released him?
I think the fact that they pursued the warrant is more indicative that they had probable cause to search the defendant's vehicle.
Go ahead.
Your opponent has suggested that the fact of a parole violation in no way, shape, or form would give rise to probable cause to search. Can you address her contention?
Certainly. Her argument is based on McCullough. And McCullough came out prior to a series of U.S. Supreme Court cases. And as this court, a division of this court, pointed out in Samuels, the foundation of McCullough, that a search must be in furtherance of the purposes of parole or probation, was rejected by the U.S. Supreme Court in Knights. And I cited to my brief Samson, that relies on the test set forth in Knights, which is a test of reasonableness. We don't need probable cause to search a parolee or a probationer. We need a reasonable search. And what we weigh is the reasonable expectation of privacy of that parolee, which is already diminished by the fact that he's on parole, with the government's interest. In Sampson, actually the officer, police officer, not the parole officer, did stop the parolee on the street. And by virtue of a prior contact in which he knew that that defendant was on parole, he searched the defendant. And the United States Supreme Court in Sampson said that was fine, that the Fourth Amendment does not protect parolees from warrantless searches by police officers.
Now, is it your position that even if the defendant had not volunteered the information about Mr. Smiley, that there would have been sufficient basis to conduct a search, even if he hadn't volunteered that information?
It would be my position that the government's interest would be lower, and perhaps the defendant's reasonable expectation of privacy would be higher. But in the circumstances of this case, a parolee who admits to a parole violation, who admits to having contraband in his car that violates the condition of his parole, I find it hard to believe that he would have any reasonable expectation of privacy.
Well, apparently he was mistaken. The officer knew, as Mr. Campbell did not, apparently, that the substance was a legal substance. And yet, the officer didn't indicate that in any way in the affidavit.
Certainly. And I don't know if we're confusing legality with permissibility under his conditions of parole.
Well, I understand there's a distinction there, but is there any contention that possession of Mr. Smiley actually was a violation of his parole?
By the defendant, there
but
was.
So you think his subjective belief is what governs here?
I think the circumstances that are known to the officer at the time, and the officers are told, I have something in my car that violates the conditions of the parole. I don't know if we can expect officers to go and research the conditions of his specific conditions of parole if the parolee himself is telling the officers that. And again, it's reasonable expectation of privacy. If a parolee believes that he has contraband in his cart, is his expectation of privacy, if he has one, reasonable? And I don't think it is. And then the government's interest will be higher because...
Counsel, can I press you on the question of this parolee issue? Because nowhere in the affidavit does it mention that he's on parole. So why are we talking about parole? He said something relatively vague. He could be returned to prison. Well, that doesn't necessarily mean he's on parole. You could be returned to prison whether or not you're on parole. So how did that communicate to the magistrate that there might be a parole violation? There's no mention of parole.
I don't believe, for purposes of the parolee search, that we need to look inside the four corners of the affidavit. This is an exception. If the court were to need to look outside the validity of the search warrant, the officers did not need the search warrant to search a parolee. They can do it without. It's an exception to the warrant.
Do they need probable cause?
No, they just need they need reasonableness.
Okay.
In Sampson, the U.S. Supreme Court said individualized suspicion is not required.
Counsel, did you make this argument, or not you, but did the prosecution make this particular argument regarding revocation of parole in the district court of the suppression hearings?
No, they did not. They were mistaken about the standard. I believe they were still relying on McCullough. But however, under Arnett's, we're not bound by the arguments made below, that if the record supports an argument, even if it wasn't presented, even if it wasn't considered by the court below, it certainly can be relied on by this court.
But that's not true with respect to any argument that might require development of a factual record, is my recollection.
Certainly, I think...
And it sounds like this one does. I mean, you'd have to develop a record on what his parole conditions were and what the officer knew, and there's just no record of that.
Well, the officer knew he was on parole. The defendant admitted. Again, this goes back to whether or not it has to actually violate the parole conditions. Perhaps mistake of law could have been used in his parole revocation hearing, or if he's ultimately tried for possession of Mr. Smiley. But for purposes of probable cause, I think we just need to look at what the officers knew at the time. The officers certainly would not have known at the time. There's no indication what his specific conditions of parole are. But again, I think if a parolee says, I'm violating the conditions of my parole, the officers don't have to do any verification whether he actually is. I think the defendant, the parolee, has given them ample grounds under the test set forth in Sampson to search the parolee, because I think a search would be reasonable.
Well, so hypothetically, if the parolee says, I've got some oregano in my car. Okay, and I'm not supposed to have oregano. That's enough for a warrant.
I think you would have to look at the circumstances and whether that would be reasonable. Again, the Mr. Smiley, he described that as synthetic marijuana or marijuana without THC, and I could certainly understand the officers thinking that a synthetic marijuana, considering all the what's going on with synthetic marijuana, would be a violation of his parole.
Counsel, what about the inconsistent information concerning whether or not guns were used in the robbery? Was this something that the magistrate judge in authorizing the warrant could or could not rely upon, and why?
I think it would be more relevant had officers Reed and Duran knew that fact at the time. They didn't know that fact. Again, Officer Blackburn testified in the suppression hearing on page 25, April 22nd, that he did not get that far into depth regarding the inconsistencies. And under case Fortune, and I believe it's...
But the affidavit, specifically attachment B to the search warrant, indicates that they want to search the car for any and all firearms. So can you address the request?
Sure. Again, it's based on what the affiant knew at the time of the affidavit, and they didn't know that he had wavered on his testimony report that there had been guns. There could have been guns. There was a report of a third person driving off in a white pickup truck, and there's many reasons that a person might retract his statement afterwards, based on he obviously knew the defendant. There's some familiarity. Who knows if they would return? He might have been scared, and that might have been why he didn't want to pursue prosecution any further. So given what he knew, he did report that there were guns, and Officer Blackburn did not communicate that he had wavered in that report. I think it was reasonable for Officers Reed and Duran to include that statement in the affidavit. Finally, I would just say that also that there was no misrepresentation that when they stated it was determined that the defendant was involved in this robbery. I think it's pretty clear that Officers Reed and Duran sincerely believed that he was involved in some sort of robbery, regardless of possession. My time is up. If there's no further questions, I would ask the court from the judgment below. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Vice, you have a minute and 13 seconds remaining.
Thank you, Your Honors. The bottom line in this case is that the police conferred when they went back to the station. They had taken Mr. Campbell back to the station, and they determined that no crime had been committed. They released him. They knew he hadn't committed a crime. They knew he hadn't committed a parole violation. They knew Mr. Smiley was legal. And as Judge Navarro pointed out, they didn't even include the pertinent fact that he was on parole as a basis. They didn't believe he was committing a parole violation.
Counsel, couldn't they, even if he was released, couldn't they have still initiated parole violation proceedings, even post-release?
Could the police have done that? Parole violation proceedings?
Or initiate the process so that the probation department could?
Perhaps they could have also conferred with his parole officer and said, hey, you know, we've got reason to believe that there's a problem here. But they didn't do that. And I think it's telling that they didn't include it in the affidavit because they didn't believe the parole violation had been committed. And I would say that the state can't raise alternate grounds not raised below pursuant to Seagal, which I said in my reply brief, when it does involve development of further factual issues. In this case, there's nothing to substantiate. And if I may finish my sentence.
You may.
I would ask the court to reverse Mr. Campbell's conviction and remand to the trial court with instructions to suppress the evidence.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments in People v. Campbell. The division will issue an opinion in this case in due course.